You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk on the Progressive Voices Network. And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today on the program, we're going to be talking about safety on the job and, well, how the Trump administration's doing, or what the Trump administration is doing to workers, as labor policy in this country appears to be heading for a return to, well, a not so great past. You know, I've often said that if I ever wanted to kill someone, really, truly, I was really angry at someone and I wanted to do them in, I would just offer them a job. I would hire them. According to the AFL-CIO report, workers are killed in this country on the job at a rate of about 13. Each and every day. These are mothers, fathers, husbands, sons, and daughters who woke up like any other ordinary day. They got showered, they got dressed, they made breakfast, they kissed their children goodbye, only to never come home again. In 2015, more than 4,800 workers were killed on the job. Add that to the reportedly nearly 50 to 60,000 workers who die from occupational exposures and diseases, and we have a real problem in this country. The AFL report says that on any day, 150 workers die from hazardous working conditions, and that nearly 3.7 million workers are being injured or suffer from work-related illnesses. And this is what we know. This is what we can, this is factual. The sad reality is many of these numbers are much, much worse due to underreporting and employers covering up injuries and illnesses because, hey, got to keep the insurance rates down. And what we know beyond exception is the no rights at work states are obviously the much, much worse places for workers when it comes to safety. Places like North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Mississippi, Arkansas are the top five worst states, or, you know, bottom five if you prefer. Here's the thing, though. Death on the job knows no political ideology. It knows no religious affiliation, no gender or race or sexual preference, none of that. But sadly, when it comes to policy, when it comes to regulation, sadly, safety on the job is a political football. We hear more and more from those on the right about deregulation and unleashing business from those burdensome and onerous rules. Got to be honest, though. Whenever I hear someone say, job-killing regulation, I think immediately of what about the worker-killing lack of protections? When I hear about them talk about, you know, job killers, those regulations, those onerous rules, I go, what made those rules in the first place? What occurred that made our Congress, our legislative bodies, pursue it? And the thing is I can't help but think about all the people that I've known throughout the years who have been injured or killed on the job. And I've known several people who have been killed, several people who have been one of those 13 that day. You know, one of the guys that sticks out in my mind, a truck driver, got up, did his run like any other day. And somebody in a four-wheeler, some car cut him off in a hurry, caused a multi-car accident, sparking off a horrible crash that ended up setting his cab on fire, and he literally burned to death. There was another driver who, due to a faulty valve in the truck, hit the brakes locked up, and he bounced off the wall and into a ravine, leaving him dead on the side of the road until he was finally discovered. Or the forklift operator who I knew of, who was killed when his tow motor slid off the dock and it crushed him. And the thing is I know all working people have heard these stories, who've known somebody, or maybe you've had a loved one. And I'm sure we've all known someone or somebody who's been injured or maimed or killed on the job. I know I do. And I think of those people, and this is the sad reality. I think of those people, and sadly, It's been so many years that I don't even really remember their names. Faces maybe a little, but I don't remember their names. But do you know who does remember their names? The people that they left behind. People like Tiffany Schwab. Tiffany is the wife of Jake Schwab. Jake was a mechanic for more than 25 years with the Erie Metropolitan Transit Authority. And back in 2014, he was killed on the job. And here in Pennsylvania, where I live, the Pennsylvania State House of Representatives held what was another hearing on a piece of legislation bearing Jake Schwab's name that would extend OSHA protections to public sector workers. Did you know that actually most states in this country, public sector workers don't have OSHA protections? None? In fact, Jake Schwab's death was really never investigated, and even his own wife hasn't been told what led to the accident that took her husband's life. So on Monday, Tiffany Schwab testified in front of the Pennsylvania House Labor and Industry Committee. Here's what she had to say.
I'm Tiffany Schwab, the widow of Jake Schwab, a 48-year-old bus mechanic that didn't deserve to lose his life so tragically to a workplace accident. On November 4th, 2014, I received a call from EMTA personnel at approximately 11 a.m. It was a phone call that I will never forget and that changed my life in such a horrific way. From that moment on, the things that his family and I had to go through were almost unbearable, as I'm sure others who have lost a loved one would understand. I remember there was one thought that repeatedly entered my mind in the days to follow: not now, not this way. That statement continued to haunt me for a while. I decided that I needed to do whatever I could to make this right in some way. I searched for answers to try to grasp what had just happened was. After 5 days in the hospital, hanging on to every bit of hope we could, Jake died as a result of his head injury. For me, I knew he had already died on the floor of a transit authority garage. The more I tried to understand what happened, the more I saw there were flaws in the system. That's why OSHA needs to have the authority over public entities, not just the private sector. The events that led up to the accident could have been prevented. Why was Jake's life cut so short when he had been at the happiest point of his life? And anyone that knows Jake knows he was full of life and was always there when anyone needed him. No one can ever replace Jake, and no one can fix the loss that we feel. He was an only son, a brother, an uncle, a true friend, and a beloved husband. Prior to the accident, he was a 27-year Class A mechanic who had extraordinary skills and who we could count on to get the job done every time. After the accident, all I could think about was that no one should have to go through the pain his family and I went through. It wasn't supposed to happen, and not that way. Please make all workplace organizations a safe environment for everyone by voting for this bill. Named after my late husband, that the union has worked so hard to create and that Pennsylvania Representative Pat Harkins endorsed. After all, don't you expect your loved one to come home from work just like I did?
Yeah, just as she said, look, every worker should come home safely to their families. Every worker should come home in the way that, look, the way they went to work at the beginning of the day. It's, to me, just that simple. In Pennsylvania, like a majority of states across the nation, lack OSHA protections for public sector workers. Did I mention to you that Jake Schwab was a public sector worker? Would it have mattered, or should it have mattered? And here to answer that question and to discuss his legislation to right this tragic injustice is Pennsylvania State Representative Pat Harkins of Erie, Pennsylvania. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate you having me on.
So what happened here? What do we know happened to this man on the day he was killed?
Well, I know that Jake Schwab got up, went to work, assuming that everything was going to be fine, I'm sure. And when he arrived at work, he probably got things ready and mingled with his coworkers. And at some point, he was asked to repair a part on a EMTA bus, and he used the wrong jack that was given to him or the supplied to him by the EMTA bus company in Erie, and that was the wrong equipment to be using at the time for the size and the weight of the bus that he was working on, and it ultimately ended up killing him.
Now, is this something that, look, I mean, is this his fault? He used the wrong tool? Is this, you know, all they had? Do we know anything about that?
Well, it's tough because the insurance company that insures the EMTA facility, they do the investigation, and they're not obliged to release anything, any details to anyone of the public or the family. That is another quirk in this legislation that I'm trying to overcome or correct going forward with this bill.
How is it possible, Pat, in this day and age, that you don't have, that there's this gap between being a public or a private sector worker? Why should it matter who you work for? You should be protected on the job. It seems idiotic to me that this is how the system is, yet states all across this country, same kind of scenario.
Well, there's 26 states that have enacted OSHA strength laws in public sector workers. Pennsylvania is not one of them, but we're hoping that soon we can be one of, we would be number 27, I believe. But it's interesting when you research it. Back in 1970, in that time frame, was when OSHA standards were started under the Nixon administration. And at the federal level, they figured they would start it there and that the states would then fall in line quickly behind that and that you would have uniformity with both public and private sectors. That didn't happen, and it wasn't until maybe 10 or 12 years ago that other states saw the need for this, and Pennsylvania wasn't one of them at the time. So when I heard about the death of Jake Schwab in Erie, I used to be a UPS driver in Erie, and I knew of Jake, and I knew of the facility where he worked at, and it was a former UPS driver that I worked with that brought it to my attention. It was in November 3 years ago, 2014, and I just felt the need to bring this legislation to a, to bring it to the forefront and introduce legislation so that Pennsylvania could be brought up to speed and made safe for everybody.
Now, this happened in 2014. I guess my first question is, why has it taken so long? Because you've introduced this a couple of times now. It makes no sense to me that this shouldn't have just gone through, because it's common sense. I mean, I meet people on the street and we have conversations about this, and no one believes me, Pat. No one believes me that there's a separation between public and private sector workers when it comes to safety on the job. They don't believe that this is true.
And even with the introduction the second time of this bill and then the hearing being broadcast statewide the night before last, I received at least 25 calls, both on my home phone, my office phone, and my cell phone, of people that are just astounded that this is so, from bus drivers to SEPTA workers to just public employees as a whole who are dumbfounded, as well as people that I used to work with that are in other industries that say, hey, we have to pay for this. We have to provide this for our employees. Why isn't it something that's in the public sector? It's just mind-boggling that it's been left to go this long, but it has, and it needs to be corrected and very quickly. But I thought when I introduced it 2 years ago that it would have been something that they would put on the forefront, but the Republican leadership just has kind of pushed it off. With the hearing that we had day before yesterday in Harrisburg, there was a strong sentiment on both sides, Republican and Democratic sides of the aisle. Once Jake Schwab's wife testified, myself and some of the other testifiers, the sentiment's there, I think, now to get something going. And a number of us agreed to get together and to form a committee where we're going to sit down and see what we can work and maybe reshape some of the things. Because I said financially, I don't want to overburden any county or municipality or school district. But when I hear from a municipality, or I hear from the County Commissioners Association or the School Boards Association, that they're worried this is going to cost them an arm and a leg, that tells me they're not doing something properly right now, and that
exactly
needs to be corrected very quickly.
Exactly. And, you know, the part of this that you know, kind of sticks in my head is that, you know, if you're doing the right thing, if you're complying with safety rules and your people aren't being injured and aren't being killed on the job, you have a lower workers' compensation cost, and you're
exactly
not being sued for someone from dying on the job. So,
right.
But, you know, here again, you know, as I listen to the testimony of the people who seemed against your piece of legislation, it all came back down to the dollars and cents. And it came back then to the idea that it's an unfunded mandate. And, oh, by the way, government shouldn't do this. It should be the private sector and insurance companies. And I got to be honest with you, I'm really uncomfortable with insurance companies being the arbitrator of safety on the job, when it's my view that their only real concern is how much money they can save, whether an accident happens or not.
And to them, it's the bottom line. But what price do you put on a human life? And even if someone lives under some of these circumstances, are they going to be a productive society member? Are they going to be somebody that's going to be a burden on themselves and their families and the insurance industry going forward? All these things come to mind. But it seemed like the testifiers from the school districts and from the County Commissioners Association, they seem to practice the buzzwords, but I don't think they know the depth of what's going on here, or what they might be setting themselves up for as far as lawsuits and everything else from survivors. It's sad that they chose to focus on the cost element when they're, in their mind, I'm sure that they think they're doing the right thing, but somehow we've got to get to them and educate them that this is something that's very serious. It needs to be taken serious, and it needs to be enacted from the legislature.
I absolutely agree with you. And here's the thing, as I sat and I watched the legislators ask their questions, it was apparent. And look, I knew most of them, and I knew which party they were from. But just based on questions, ideologically, there seems to be a massive split. Whereas you would think that something like this, making sure that people go home safe at the end of the day, that no one gets harmed on the job, either through injury or being killed on the job, you would think that that would be something that would unite both sides of the aisle. Yet there's just this belief, I guess, on the Republican side of, the free market will take care of it. Insurance companies will take care of it. We don't need more government. And I got to be honest, I want government to be proactive in making sure that there are no more Jake Schwabs. I want them to be proactive in making sure that every workplace in our Commonwealth and across this country is safe for every worker, not just whether you're a public sector or a private sector worker.
And like I said, continuously since I've introduced this bill, I point out the fact that I had worked for UPS, a private entity, for 25 years. And every day we have an interview. We had a pre-work communication CM. Today you were tested, and oftentimes you had to do hazmat training. You had to know what chemicals you might be dealing with during the day, as well as safety and driving. And you were often rewarded for your years of service, as well as your years of safe driving and safe years of service with the company. So that company spent a lot of money to make sure that we were safe and to make sure that their costs were down, as far as back injuries and shoulder injuries and things like that. Now I understand that they have a school that they send employees to, and you pass or fail, and if you fail, you don't work for them. But they take it very seriously, they invest the money in it, and they see the critical need for safety. When you put a vehicle out on the public streets, like a school bus, you've got to make sure that you've got the right people handling that with the precious commodity of the children on the bus, as well as interacting and driving, with the other people that are on the city streets and county streets and state roads and highways.
It's just amazing. So how do we get this passed through? And not just in Pennsylvania, but in other states across the country that don't have this.
Well, I've been working with some people from Washington with OSHA. I've talked to a number of people locally, meaning in Harrisburg, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Erie, Reading, Scranton, Johnstown. There is a large push to get this moving. I think that I think we're on the right road. And like I said, after the meeting the other day, there were a number of Republicans who approached me and said that they are willing to work with me. And it's some people like from the Policemen's Association, the Firemen's Association. A number of people are coming on board because they see the need for it within their workplace. And also when you hear about boilers exploding in schools, a number of school district people around the state have contacted me or contacted my office and said they want to be of help with it. So it's a building momentum issue, but I would like to get it done in Pennsylvania and let us be a model for other states to join in with.
Yeah, good stuff. I just want to highlight before we wrap this up that, this man was killed on the job and there wasn't a public investigation. So we don't actually really know what happened to this man, do we?
No, and that's the tough part for the family. They are trying to heal and go through the grieving process, but there's nothing there for them from the insurance industry, and it's as though they are being pushed aside, and I found that very, very wrong. Put yourself in somebody else's shoes and imagine how you would feel if you went through this with the grieving with another family member passing away.
Pat, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much, and best of luck on this. And as this goes through, we'd love to have you back and talk about the victory on the other end and how we keep workers safe across the Commonwealth and across the country.
I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate your help with moving the legislation. I'm looking forward to having some good debate and some good dialogue with my colleagues going forward on it.
Good stuff. Thanks so much, Pat. As Pat said, there was a hearing that happened, and one of the people who testified along with Jake Schwab's widow was Dave Filmon. He's the executive director of AFSCME Council 13. He testified on behalf of the Jake Schwab bill. Here's what he had to say.
My name is Dave Filmon. I'm the executive director of AFSCME Council 13. As you may know, Council 13 represents more than 65,000 public workers in the state, county, municipal, township, borough, and school governments, along with nonprofits and authorities. These workers, on a daily basis, perform some of the most dangerous jobs in the Commonwealth, yet they are not afforded the on-the-job safety standards of their private sector counterparts, whether that's working on a highway construction site, a hospital setting, or an administrative office. The latest figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics indicate that lost time injuries are twice as frequent for public employees as for private workers. That lost time alone is a tremendous cost to public employers and is preventable. Since OSHA became the law of the land in 1970 for private sector workers, 26 states or U.S. territories have adopted some form of public employee OSHA coverage. It's been reported by the United States Department of Labor the adoption of these safety standards caused a reduction in the number of workplace accidents, injuries, and deaths in these jurisdictions. The effect was the saving of millions of dollars in workers' compensation costs, lost time on the job, sick leave, and overtime payments. Creating an OSHA state plan for public employees here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is the right thing to do. New Jersey, New York, Maine, Connecticut, Illinois have all established state OSHA plans for public employees. Safe workplaces for public employees is a matter of fundamental fairness. Public employees of this state deserve no less the guarantee of a safe workplace than any other worker. For many years, states across the country have relied on OSHA for direction and guidance for the occupational safety and health programs, except Pennsylvania. I believe what you will hear today from other testifiers will be the cost that we incurred if they have to apply OSHA regulations in the workplace throughout the Commonwealth. If the Commonwealth, local governments, school districts, and others who are working to ensure that workplaces are safe, this will not be a problem for them. The cost will be minimal. House Bill 1082 will only increase workplace safety for those already following and complying with existing laws. For those who are not following safety rules and regulations, they're out there. House Bill 1082 and will now force them to comply with those regulations. Compared to years ago, public employees in today's workplace handle all types of hazardous chemicals, hazardous materials, operate heavy machinery, and do other jobs that were never performed years ago in their day-to-day duties. You understand for some to comply with those rules will have some upfront costs. Step up and implement this law. The money spent means a safer workplace for their employees and future cost savings for the Commonwealth, local governments, school districts, and others. The time is now for the Pennsylvania General Assembly to pass legislation, stop treating public employees like second-class citizens, and protect their lives from injuries and possible death. This is why AFSCME Council 13 fully supports House Bill 1082. I ask this committee and all of the House of Representatives to do the same. Thank you.
So we've been talking a lot about safety on the job, especially about workers in general. But what about safety in your paycheck? What about not getting ripped off? What about the rules that are still in place? What's the Trump administration been doing on that front? And here to talk a little bit about it, I've asked Dave Jamison to come talk with us. He's a labor reporter over at Huffington Post. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Good to be here.
So, you know, I look at, you know, the last several months under President Trump, and everything it appears that he and his administration are doing is to just dismantle everything that Barack Obama did, whether it was good or bad or indifferent. It was, if Obama's name was on it, it's got to go.
Yeah, that's pretty much been the attitude. And you know, let's be fair. He was pretty upfront about that during the campaign, that's what he planned on doing. And that's pretty much what he has been doing. And if you follow labor stuff, you know that a lot of what Obama did through executive order in his last couple of years was on the workplace front. So he issued a lot of executive orders and did a lot through rulemaking to change the way we work and increase regulation on a lot of employers. And Trump has really repealed a whole lot of that in concert with congressional Republicans who use this fairly arcane tool called the Congressional Review Act to undo a lot of what was done in kind of the last days of the Obama presidency. And, Trump has said all along that he wanted to peel back so much of what his predecessor did. And you know, we're not quite a year along, but he's gone a long way in doing that.
Yeah, he has. And some of the things that, you know, I thought Obama did were very small things, like trying to help encourage workers to join and form unions, and some of the minor steps forward to help in that. Even that is something that's being, you know, frozen, and I would argue eventually being majorly pushed back on.
Yeah, I think that there's some stuff that he's repealed that I think a lot of people didn't even realize was there until he undid it. And what he did this week is a pretty good example of that. The Labor Department has moved to repeal this rule on restaurant server tips that the Obama administration did. They did this in 2011. Not a lot of people knew about it. What all Obama did was they set this rule saying that a server's tips belong to the server, and a restaurant can't take those tips and disperse them among other workers. The restaurant industry didn't like when they did this, but it's not something that you really heard a whole lot about over the last few years. But this week they came out, they announced their reopening the rule, and they're going to do away with it. So that has a lot of people upset, and it's really, really upset. People who were in the Obama administration when they did this.
Now, what does that mean? I mean, when you go to a restaurant and you tip your waiter or your waitress, I think we all believe that goes to that waiter or waitress. How would this rule change? How would this affect that waiter or waitress and the tip money that we leave?
So historically, restaurants have done this thing called tip pooling. And this is a way to kind of take the gratuities that come into the front of the house workers and spread them out around everybody. Okay, so, when you go to a restaurant, you go to the diner, you leave a tip, that's obviously in your mind for the server. But there's other staff, there's dishwashers, there's cooks in the kitchen. And a lot of restaurants like to spread those tips around so that those people in the back of the house get a piece of it too. There are a lot of, worker advocates out there who don't like the idea of restaurants running these tip pools because you think you're leaving this for the server and it gets kind of appropriated by the house and then distributed as management wants to. So the Obama administration set the rules so that if a server gets a tip under any circumstances, that stays with the server. And a lot of worker groups like that because they think, hey, all right, if the restaurant thinks the guy in the back of the house, the cook should be making more money, then they should pay more money rather than take another worker's tips to subsidize the work in the back of the house.
Agreed.
So those worker groups were happy that the Obama administration did this. The restaurant industry was not. The National Restaurant Association sued to block this rule. They really did not like it. And look, I have a lot of friends in the hospitality industry, and tip pools are it's not a crazy idea. Everybody wants the cook and the dishwasher to get something as well. And this has been customary in the industry. The problem is, the way this rule was rewritten is nothing saying that money has to go to the workers anywhere, be it the front of the house or the back of the house. So a big concern, you know, among former, especially among the former Obama administration officials, is that the way the Trump administration is redoing this is basically that, that in theory, the house could keep the money for itself. So long as they're paying, you know, minimum wage, you know, under this, under the rewriting of this rule, the house would be able to appropriate the tips and do whatever it wants with them, including not redistribute them at all.
Yeah, and that, this isn't just restaurant workers; it's any tipped employee, right?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, clearly the biggest impact would be among restaurant and bar staff, just because the restaurant industry is so large, and most of the vast majority of tipped workers in the country are concentrated in that industry.
Yeah, I remember back when I first met my wife; she was working on weekends as a part-time job, giving horseback riding tours. And I was volunteering as a big brother at the time, and I had taken my little brother there, and I met her, and at the end they give you an envelope to say if you enjoyed your tour, you know, please leave a tip. And, you know, I really liked the tour guide who would eventually be my wife, so I left a sizable tip. And it wasn't until years later that my wife let it out of the bag that she had no idea what I had given it a tip, because the company had pooled all that money and said none of the tip money went to the employees. They provided the full-time people a week's vacation, so she had no idea. And here I was, I gave like double what it cost to do the ride, and she never even knew about it.
Yeah, you know, problem here, the administration says, you know, okay, you know, they've sort of acknowledged that there is this hole in there where there is no actual requirement to redistribute the money among the workers. You know, they say that, but, you know, their argument is, well, restaurants wouldn't actually do that. You know, that their workers would be up in arms if they just took the tips and didn't give them to the workers. But, you know, you look around, we already have a problem throughout the service industry of these, like, service fees being tacked onto, you know, stuff we buy in restaurants, hotels, sports stadiums. This is a problem at Yankee Stadium, where, you know, there's an automatic 20% service fee tacked on to beer and hot dogs and stuff. And it turns out, the beer vendors are only getting like 4 or 6% of that, and the house is pocketing the rest. You know, so there already is a precedent of companies being willing to be really misleading about this, if not outright stealing, when it comes to these tips. So I think it's reasonable to think that if the letter of the law allows employers to pocket their gratuities, I don't think it's crazy to think at least some of those bad actors out there will do that. I mean, I think any decent employer and anybody who doesn't want to really piss off the staff isn't going to try to do that. But you know, the record shows that there are some out there like that. So I think it's a very legitimate issue.
I do as well. And another reason that I'm not in favor of having tipped employees, I think you should pay your workers a decent living wage. They should come to work, do their job, and be able to support their families, not on the goodwill of the people who come into the restaurant, but because, as a matter of course. Just my thought on it, though.
Yeah, and that's really why a lot of worker advocates in the industry hate the idea of tip pooling in general, because it creates a situation where you're relying more and more on customers to subsidize the wages that, you know, they think the employers themselves should be paying.
It's
the whole idea of the tip credit. You know, we still have a lot of tipped workers in this country who are making as little as $2.13 an hour in pay from their employers, and it's left to diners to subsidize the rest.
Again, another reason I think that we should just do away with the whole thing. But here's the other part of this, and this is where I keep coming back to, you know, having that power of collective bargaining, having the power to organize to make people's lives better, to be able to get better wages, hours, and conditions, and maybe a rebirth of the labor movement in pursuing these kind of jobs. Because, look, you know, my grandfather used to tell me that, you know, driving a truck was a horrible job. Working in a coal mine was a terrible job. Factory work was terrible until they were union jobs. And then they just paid a lot better. They were still hard, difficult jobs, but you could make a living at it. I believe any job could be a family-sustaining job, just as long as you have the ability to organize, fight for those better wages, hours, and conditions. Curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, we always think of factory jobs, say auto work and in Detroit as this kind of, you know, we equate it with solid middle class sustaining work that was manual labor. But, you know, let's remember, there's nothing like inherently good or well paying about auto work. You know, the reason those jobs became good was because of collective bargaining.
Yep.
So, you know, that's something, you know, we have to remember, even when it comes to retail work. You know, there are good retail jobs out there, or decent ones, and there are some really crappy ones. And often a collective bargaining agreement is makes the difference there. When you look at some you know, long running union jobs in retail at places like Macy's and like that, where you do have people who have been in the same store for two decades because they've been able to make a go out of it, and they've been able to build a career at it. And you know, compare that to a lot of other retail jobs that are paying much closer to minimum wage and with really high turnover. You know, so I do, you know, I absolutely think that you know, a union can make a difference in the quality of work like that.
So let me ask you, because you've written a piece on evidently that you claim the Democrats have this ambitious plan to help rebuild labor unions. What's the grand plan?
Oh, I'd be curious your thoughts. I have no idea what the Democrats' grand plan is to rebuild labor. I mean, you know, that they are at least now throwing out some ideas. You know, the problem is there isn't a whole, you know, that right now they can pretty much say anything because there isn't much they can do.
Right.
It is nice to see them, you know, really kind of discussing things like, you know, the way unions have been diminished and the way labor law is set up that makes it very difficult for unions to grow. So I think they are talking about these things now, you know, now that they are in the minority and we see, you know, Republicans around the country really taking an axe to collective bargaining. But I think, you know, what's going to matter is, you know, when Democrats, you know, if and when they retake control, is what should matter to unions is whether they're actually going to follow through on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, for me.
So I think, you know, we are at a point where Democrats on the Hill are discussing this stuff. But, you know, this would take years to change. And, you know, we're seeing attacks around the country, particularly on the state level. That's making it harder for unions to not just to grow, but to survive. You know, we're at a point where a majority of states are now right to work. And that trend is only heading in one direction. So, you know, it's pretty dire times. And I think, you know, a lot of unions are having discussions about particularly, you know, still following the elections from last year about, you know, what they need to do to, you know, to elect politicians who are going to help the labor movement.
Again, I think the Democrats have to rediscover their roots. We need a new deal, and I would argue the first step would be going back and repealing and getting rid of Taft-Hartley, but that's a whole nother discussion. Dave, I appreciate your thoughts.
Yeah,
and
that is what, you know, a lot of what Democrats talked about in their plan. You know, they released this plank as part of their better deal agenda, which that specifically addresses, you know, labor issues, and a lot of it goes right to Taft-Hartley, you know, and, you know, one of the measures in there would basically ban right-to-work laws. So, you know, obviously it's a really very difficult road to go, but, you know, it's interesting to see them talking about this
finally. Good stuff. Dave, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Hey, Rick, my pleasure.
Thanks for the work you do. Again, if you want to check out some of his stuff, we'll get a link at thericksmithshow.com. So I think, you know, Dave Jamison had a point there, and it got me thinking about my grandparents. Look, the reality is my grandparents' generation, they're the ones who took those crummy factory jobs and turned them into really good union jobs. And, you know, I was thinking about my grandfather, who told the story about when he first started driving back, you know, 30s. He was making 17 cents an hour shoveling coal off the back of a coal truck, you know, 12, 15 hours a day, 18 hours a day, and basically homeless. Poverty jobs, hard work, and very little reward. And you know, I think about their lives and how they fought and they were determined to make better lives, not just for themselves, but also for their children. And, you know, I think about that. You know, my grandmother was a cashier at a small department store, had a very good living. My grandfather was a truck driver, good union jobs, and they retired with dignity. They both retired with a divine benefit pension fund. They both had Social Security. They both had savings. They had that three-legged stool so that when they retired, they weren't destitute. Up until the end of their lives, they didn't want. They didn't fear. What we're doing right now and what's happening as we're breaking up unions and destroying these good jobs is what we're making sure that the next generation doesn't get to retire. And it just got me thinking about some of this stuff because, you know, those jobs were crummy jobs until they were union jobs. In fact, my grandmother retired in 1985. She was making just about $8 an hour with full health care, didn't pay a dime for it, dental care, didn't pay a dime for it, vision, didn't pay a dime for it, pension that she, you know, she collected up until, well, she passed in 2016, didn't have to really contribute to it. It was part of her wage package. It was part of what the union fought for. It was part of the better wages, hours, conditions that she had, you know, 6 weeks vacation. You could just go down the list of all the great things that they had. And what ended up happening is you had the Kmarts and the Walmarts and these big box retailers came and destroyed everything. Went from solid, decent wage, family-sustaining jobs to poverty jobs. And that has happened industry after industry. And it's because, you know, we've allowed these right-wing cranks to go after labor laws and to use labor laws against workers. And look, I've said for a very long time, the Democrats had better get their heads out of the you-know-whats, because at the end of it, Taft-Hartley was the worst thing that ever happened to the labor movement. And they've used constantly small incremental attacks to slowly take away the rights to organize, slowly move the pendulum to the side of the employer until where we are right now. Workers don't go on strike anymore. They get locked out. The employer seems to be holding all the cards because, look, our politicians seem to be in their pockets as well. And I, you know, I think back to my grandparents' generation. How would they have responded? And I think they would have responded by organizing, by stepping together and by saying, hell no, we're not going to allow this to happen. Just what I thought. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you have a story like that? I'd love to hear it. Quick break, right back.
Brought to you by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor organization representing 200,000 transit workers in the United States and Canada. The ATU works to promote transit issues and fights for the interests of its hardworking members and riders.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1869. That was the day black workers met in Washington, D.C. to found the Colored National Labor Union. 214 black trade unionists hoped to work toward equal representation in the workforce. They also demanded anti-discrimination legislation, federally funded education, and the fulfillment of the promise of 40 acres and a mule for Southern farmers. 34-year-old black caulker Isaac Myers was elected the organization's first president. He had organized black caulkers in the Chesapeake shipyards. Myers hoped to lead black workers into the National Labor Union, an early effort at building a national labor movement. National Labor Union founder William Silvis insisted there should not be distinction of race or nationality among the ranks. Myers added that white and black workers must come together in solidarity and organize for higher wages and living standards. Many members of the National Labor Union were not so progressive when it came to integrated unions. Some of these organizations had whites-only clauses in their bylaws. Others feared competition from black workers and voted not to extend membership. Myers understood the need to organize black workers. While the National Labor Union did not live up to its stated ideal of inclusion, Myers' efforts welcomed all workers regardless of race, gender, or occupation, and represented workers across 21 states. They were soon met with the full weight of resistance that hostile bosses, media, and the government brought down upon them when they tried to push for reforms of any kind. Though the colored National Labor Union soon fell into decline, black workers carried on its ideals of interracial solidarity during the Great Strikes of 1877. So did the new Knights of Labor, who insisted an injury to one is an injury to all. So back to find out what's going on in the streets, because we've been seeing lots of stories of activity of folks out in the streets, and here to give us the update, the skinny, the lowdown, our good friend Kevin Mahoney, Raging Chicken Press. Kevin, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, man, I don't know how things could get crazier, let me tell you. I mean, but I one good thing I'll have to say is there's nothing better than for a revolting tax bill than a tax revolt.
Yeah, no, I've been asking the question, where's the Tea Party? Yep. Where are all the Tea Party people who are screaming about, I'm taxed enough already? This is actually going to raise your taxes in multiple ways, and yet not a peep from those flag-waving T-twits.
It's astounding. Well, it shows you how deep that goes, right? And it shows you the how much of a farce that whole kind of agenda was. Because we see a tax bill that is going to have, I mean, you've been talking about this nonstop, Rick, of course, but we're going to talk about fundamental redistribution of wealth. We're going to actually alter the shape of American society if this tax bill continues and goes through. We're going to all feel the impacts. And I think that people are starting to kind of realize it. I'm only hoping it's not way too late. Although I'm not feeling good about it, the only thing that's good about it is that you could see the protests are ramping up and becoming even that much more muscular, that much more militant this week.
Yeah, I said before they rammed it through in their 2 a.m. theft on a Saturday night, yeah, that this could be the greatest Christmas gift that the Republicans could have given the Democrats. Because, look, this stuff can be undone down the road. It's just a matter of will we undo it?
Well, that's just exactly it. And this is why I was very happy to see that Bernie Sanders was hitting the road again and doing some campaign-style rallies across the country at places like Reading, Pennsylvania, right down the road from me, out in Dayton, Ohio. Look at Akron, Ohio. Originally was scheduled to go down to Kentucky, but had to stay, right, as the tax bill was still being debated on the floor. So that's the kind of thing that we're going to need, because one of the things that, we cannot sit on our laurels about. It's not simply about going back to where things were under Obama. That ship has sailed. Right now, we need a kind of an agenda and a way of articulating a way forward that is going to be about a fundamental different vision for the society. Enough of the neoliberal economics, enough of this halfway measures. It's time to articulate something that is going to be pro-worker, pro-family, pro-community, and is actually going to kind of bring the community back to this country and get away from the kind of divisive politics that we've seen for too long. And that's going to take not only the booting of the Republican Party out of office next election season, but also a fundamental reform of the Democratic Party.
No, I mean, and maybe a return to the roots. And I've been saying for a very long time, we need a new deal. We need to reengage society, make sure that workers have collective bargaining rights, have a progressive tax code, and actually invest in the future. It just seems to me that the time is right now. And look, as I said,
right,
I think the Republicans have done a major service for the Democrats in giving them this if it passes.
Yes, and it's also done a major service for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, too, as well. And that's what makes it even that much better. And, you know, again, when you talk about the New Deal, if you look at some of the constituencies, the people that were out in the streets, that were occupying senators' offices, that were arrested this past week, as we saw, again, when we talked last week, we were talking about the sit-ins that were taking place in senators' offices around the country. This week, we had the halls of the Capitol, right in Congress, flooded with people, hundreds of people showing up from around the country, basically chanting, tax the rich, not the sick. Now, can you imagine this? That kind of message happened even 5 years ago, Rick? I don't know about it. Unless it would be covered by some fringe group saying that stuff. Now you've got people, everyday people who are going to be impacted by this bill showing up. You've got 8 graduate students were arrested outside of Paul Ryan's office in D.C. this week, on Tuesday. And they were all wearing their red shirts and fighting for the future of higher ed and chanting, kill the bill, kill the bill. When Ryan refused to answer the door, refused to let them in, they were dragged off and arrested. And again, these are graduate students from around the country whose lives are just going to be turned upside down with this tax bill. And the messaging that they're coming forward with is a messaging that harkens back to what we saw in the arguments for a New Deal, right? Except now we even have, I would argue, even a broader base of constituencies that are fighting back. So there's a lot of hope here if the organizing continues.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. And also, you know, not just Paul Ryan's office where people are arrested. Even you know, Susan Collins had people
right.
arrested coming out of her office. Because, look, this is really unpopular. In fact, you know, I think the last Quinnipiac Gallup polls that I've seen put the approval of this bill at around 29%, which is pathetically low.
Yeah, it's pathetically low. It's about the approval rating of Trump right now, right? I mean, that basically represents that Trump's core supporters. And I want to be clear here. I have a real problem with the messaging that comes out that talks about this tax bill as a Trump tax bill. Because as you know, as you've talked about it for a long time, we've talked about it for a long time. This is a Republican tax yep. bill. This is not something new. This is something they have been arguing for decades. So I have no patience at all to hear about, well, you know, the problem with the tax bill is that, you know, they're trying to ram it through. They did it too quickly. No. This is what they've been sitting on for the past two decades. And I think that jig is up, man, is that what we're seeing right now is people kind of pushing past that and arguing for a different vision of kind of the way that we should be living here, not like this austerity politics for the past several decades.
No, look, I'm seeing, you know, people like Stephen Moore, you know, still arguing that trickle-down economics works,
yeah.
even though we've got 40 years of proof that shows it doesn't.
Yeah, we've been trickled down on for a little bit too long now, Rick.
Yeah, and it's not the rivers of gold and honey that I was promised. It's yellow, but it's not gold and honey. Let's move on. Evidently, some grad students organizing, fighting back.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a quick one. It's kind of connected to the fight back on the tax bill. But, you know, we saw walkouts that took place over 50 campuses across the country on Friday as this tax bill was being debated. Because graduate students, of course, are going to be, like I said, their lives are going to be turned upside down because this bill will basically make all their tuition waivers, they'll be treated as income. So instead of having to pay taxes on the $15,000 stipend that you might get if you're lucky over the course of a year, you're going to have to pay it on that plus tuition. So you could be paying taxes on $65,000, $75,000. When you're only bringing home about $15,000. So the walkouts took place last Friday, and this week you're seeing the kind of the next wave of that happening. On my own campus at Kutztown University, there's going to be a walkout on Thursday. Today, there's going to be ones across the country. On Wednesday, Rutgers University has a walkout. So you're basically seeing the same kind of model that we've seen in the post-Trump era, where people are basically taking this back to the kind of the local campuses, the local constituencies in their communities and fighting back, which is what we need. We need that organizing to be taking place in the communities, not just in Washington, D.C. So that's an awesome sign.
I mean, you see students, you know, now you've got students striking. Also in Oakland, California, you've got public sector workers out on strike. Tell me what's going on there.
Yeah, that's right. You got 3,000 city workers in Oakland, California went on strike on Tuesday after talks broke down. Now, they had a short walkout earlier on in the year, too, as well, and kind of protest of the way that they were being treated at the negotiations table. Well, look, I mean, they're out on the streets, too, beginning on Tuesday. It was supposed to be a one-day strike, but there was no movement. There was no agreement, so they went back. You know, they went back. Went back on Wednesday and began continued the strike. And again, the idea is there's two things. Number one, the erosion of wages and benefits, right, which we see across the country. That's number one. And number two, the increasing reliance on part-time workers to do full-time work, right? So it's the same struggle that we see again and again and again. And these workers in Oakland are saying, nope, not doing it. We've had enough. We've been without a contract since July. We're walking out until we get a fair contract and people bargain in good faith.
Good on them. Look, at the end of the day, these battles are going to happen all across the country. Look, Oakland is one of those areas where cost of living is just going through the roof.
Exactly.
All of California, the cost of living and the inflation, not just in California, but across this country. And wages have stagnated and in many cases actually declined, especially when you take in cost of living. It's about time. Let's move on. Battling for the internet. Protests this week and days of actions coming up.
That's right, on Thursday, because we saw that was the big days of action at Verizon stores across the country. Hundreds of these actions were taking place right up until the time the actions were taking place at Verizon stores, demanding a pushback, a stop to the rollback of net neutrality rules that the FCC will be voting on December 14th. Right up until the time that the actions were happening, more people were being added, more actions are being added, and this is good. So I want to say, everybody, look, the battle's not over. It's not a one-day thing. December 14th is the vote. I would encourage everybody to go to the battleforthenet.com to find out more information about how to contact your legislators, to get some model language of kind of what you need to say to them, right? You can also go to Fight for the Future's Facebook page to see the places where there's going to be increasing numbers of actions right up until the December 14th thing. We can't emphasize enough how important it is to maintain these net neutrality rules to prevent the corporate takeover of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, if you want an open and free internet like we have, if you want things like they are now, understand this is major change and not for the better.
No, this is basically like, this is the version. If you look at what happened with the Trump election, this is the internet's version of the Trump election. If they get rid of the net neutrality rules, we might as well kind of not learn the lessons that we kind of got taught the hard way this past election cycle. It can be really, really bad. You don't like it now? Okay, I get that. But it's going to only get worse if these rules are rolled back.
And finally, this week, we saw the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke say that they're shrinking the size of a couple of national monuments in Utah. And I don't know what we're going to do with the land, but evidently we're shrinking it down.
Yeah, you know, well, you got to sell it off, Rick. You know, I mean, these public resources are just sitting around. It's capital that's not being capitalized upon for the few, for the top 1%. So that's what they did. Two national monuments in Utah, nearly 2 million acres combined. We're just going to be, like, auctioned off. You know, hey, we're no longer going to make these public lands. We're going to make these open for, you know, the market to do. But what was interesting about this, too, as well, is that from some unlikely places, perhaps, you saw Patagonia and REI are now, like, publicly speaking out against Trump's order to basically sell off or reduce the size of these national parks, right? And visitors that were doing their, you know, holiday shopping went to Patagonia, went to REI's website. They were greeted with a message that said this, quote, "The president stole your land in an illegal move. The president just reduced the size of Bear's End and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. This is the largest elimination of protected land in American history." So the fight back has begun. We saw kind of some movements going out on Twitter and on Facebook under the hashtag Monumental Mistakes, protesting Trump's orders. And you also have a series of lawsuits that are now being filed, basically saying what the president has done, what the Interior Secretary has basically done, is an illegal act of kind of enclosure of public lands.
And as I understand, it's not just these two. There are a number of other ones in California and Oregon that they're also, I guess, looking at going after, right?
That's correct. And in some of these lands, actually, where they want to go after, this is just the first round here. And many of these lands are also kind of either butt up or are also part of American Indian reservation land, right? So you actually see a combination of, you know, environmentalist groups and kind of indigenous peoples organizations joining together for this particular kind of pushback. So, you know, I'm just in time for holiday shopping. You know, this is the kind of pushback you want to see from kind of retailers who have been historically associated with these kind of open spaces. So good on them.
Yeah, good on them. Kevin, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
All right, Rick, take it easy.
Thanks so much, Kevin Mahoney, Raging Chicken Press. Look, he hit on a couple of really important things. The net neutrality thing, big, big deal. Check out that website, battleforthenet.com. Look, lots of things to get involved in, lots of things to pay attention to. I'd love to hear what it is that you are passionate about, something we should be covering here on the program. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Say, hey, this is important, be it the national monuments that I guess are now shrinking, be it the web. I'd love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Share your thoughts with us, and we will share it with the world. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here again next week. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show, heard here on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day an explosion rocked Fairmont Coal Company's number 6 and number 8 coal mines in Monaga, West Virginia, killing 367 miners. Newspaper reports estimated the number of dead to be as high as 500. It is considered the worst mine disaster in the history of the United States. Most miners were killed instantly, as the explosion destroyed the mine entrance and its ventilation system. Those not killed instantly suffocated from poisonous gas. Earth tremors were felt 8 miles away. The force of the explosion buckled pavement, collapsed buildings, and derailed streetcars. More than 3,200 miners had died in 1907. There were 3 more mine disasters before the end of the year. The last month became known as Black December. In January, a coroner's jury verdict ruled that a blowout shot ignited coal dust and made a number of recommendations for safer practices. But David McAteer tells a different story in his history of the disaster. He argues that the tipple had a design flaw that led to occasional coal car derailments as they exited the mine. And on this day, there had been a derailment with coal cars crashing at the bottom of the shaft and taking out the electrical and ventilation systems with it, igniting the coal dust in the process. The disaster generated a surge in demands for greater mine safety, leading to the creation of the Bureau of Mines in 1910. The Bureau could conduct research and safety training, but were powerless to conduct inspections or safety enforcement. Miners would continue to fight for the better part of the century for safety regulations and enforcement. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.